Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber. As we continue our discussion with Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University and the man behind The Modern and the Postmodern, one of Coursera's most popular humanities MOOCs, we're turning the subject of how his experience teaching a massive online course might impact how he next teaches the classroom version of the course.
One of the things I learned in the class is the staying power of an education in the liberal arts. What I mean by that is the ways in which working through these books seems so meaningful and powerful to people of extraordinarily different backgrounds and ages. That was, for me, the most exciting and energizing part of the experience. You might remember there's this one guy who was retired living in France who's, I think he was a producer of a very important TV show here in the United States, and that I wrote for a living all my life, and now I'm freaking out to hand in my 800-word essay on Nietzsche. That was music to my ears. Or the person in Singapore who read Emerson and just, you know, is blown away by it and thinks it's a life-changing experience. Or the guy in England who's taking care of his elderly mother who finds it's a kind of path to freedom to be able to think outside of the confines of his particular situation. Those lessons I found energizing and also humbling. I'm trying to figure out how to translate that back to a group of, you know, very talented and eager 18 and 19-year-olds. I can't just tell them that, they won't believe it. You know, when you're 19, that's not something that sinks in. But trying to integrate into my classroom the lessons that this kind of learning really is lifelong learning, I mean, that's a great challenge. I do expect to do some peer grading. I do use a discussion board in my campus class, but it doesn't have the kind of participation that you have in Coursera. That may be because they can talk, you know, face-to-face in class, so they don't need it in the same way. I am thinking of trying to connect some of the students in the online class with the students in the classroom. I know that some professors at Princeton tried that, you know, with a kind of big Google Hangout, and I'm interested in seeing if that might work. And I'm going to be talking with my TAs about what they see as possible connections. You know, at Wesleyan, we have graduate programs, but only in the sciences and ethnomusicology. So I didn't have grad students as TAs. I had freshmen and sophomore TAs who had just taken the class with me, and they were great. They have a very good understanding, because it's so fresh, of the two modalities. I'll give you one example of what I thought I was going to do, and they dissuaded me from doing. I thought I would no longer lecture in the campus version, that I would simply make my online materials available to the Wesleyan students. I wasn't sure what I would do when I got to class, because I still have 100 people. I can't run it like a seminar. But when I told that to the TAs, they vigorously objected, and they said that my online lectures were completely different from their experience of the classroom at Wesleyan. At Wesleyan, when I walk into the classroom armed with the text of the week, and I ask the students for questions, and my lecture really is going to be generated out of the student interaction. And they said to get rid of that dimension of the class would be a huge loss. And so they said, you know, don't think you can flip this classroom just because that's the jargon of the day. What happens in classroom is not just a lecture. So that was very interesting to me, because flip side of that was when I started the Coursera class, I thought I could just take my Wesleyan campus class and use that. It would be much easier, right? And when I watched the tapes, they were just so boring, because I wasn't engaging with the viewer. I was engaging with the students in the room. And so that's why we went to this mode where I talk to a camera, so it feels like I'm talking to the viewer. And then we cut in parts of the classroom experience so people have a sense of the energy of the classroom, but also feel that this is a lecture delivered for the online student. All of that is to say my assumptions about how this would translate have been wrong so far. So I want to continue to experiment. We're offering the Coursera version again late July. I don't know if that's the best time to do it, but the Coursera folks and our team here decide what works best. And I'm very interested in seeing how these experiments evolve. I just spoke to a group of college presidents and provosts from liberal arts schools around the country about this, and apparently there's a lot of anxiety about these kinds of classes and what they mean for life on campus. I actually think that these kinds of classes show an enormous appetite for the kind of learning that we facilitate on campus, and a lot of the students online would love to have the opportunity to be on campus and have the face-to-face version of this. And so I don't see this as a zero-sum game where if you do more online, you do less on campus. For some students, that may be the case. But I think what we're doing is really expanding the possibilities of education, and that, as an educator, is what we should be doing.
From your perch as a classroom teacher, now a MOOC teacher, but also an administrator, you mentioned that the way MOOCs and other online learning tools are going to be fitting into sort of a wider educational multiverse is kind of open to question. I'm curious how you see MOOCs playing with some of the other issues I know you've spoken out before, such as the skyrocketing costs of higher education and the need to reach out to a wider community. Where do you think MOOCs are going to be fitting into this wider universe?
It's really hard to tell. I joke that, as a historian, I've been wrong about the 19th century a lot, so predicting the 21st century going forward is hazardous stuff. But I think that as MOOCs evolve, some of them will prove to be credit-worthy at many institutions. And at the very least, they have added pressure on all of us to think about what we mean by credit-worthiness. The accreditors for a long time just meant how many hours you sit in the seat, and that clearly is preposterous as a way of validating credit. So I think that these MOOCs will improve and will be able to more rigorously determine who did the work and what they learned in the class, and if they learned enough to get credit, I don't see any reason to deny credit for a MOOC because it's delivered through that certain technological platform. And that will have an impact on many schools. And hundreds of schools, if not more, are already giving credit for classes online. So that's not a hard thing to imagine. It's happening all over the place already. And it's hugely important for people who can't make their way to campuses to have the in-person experience. It also will put a lot of pressure on schools that have classes of many, many hundreds of students, because it's very unclear why that's preferable to a MOOC. You're sitting in an auditorium with 600 people listening to somebody talk about whatever the subject is while you look at your Facebook in the auditorium or do your email, which is common practice at large universities across the country. And why is the MOOC not preferable to that? I have no idea. But at places like Westbeam, where 3/4 of our classes are small ones, that's a different kind of educational experience. I think the president of MIT has described MOOCs as, kind of the contemporary version of textbooks. And a lot of them will just be used as textbooks. I think that's true. And you can imagine a situation where someone masters a textbook and demands credit for doing so. But for most students, that's a very hard thing to do. And that's why I think most students will probably not be able to get credit through MOOCs, because it's not so easy to actually do the work adequately without any face-to-face or personal connection to an instructor. But that will evolve. There are certainly schools already that are using MOOCs and TAs, for example. Or my colleague in psychology, Lisa Dierker, whose MOOC was in statistics, she had a lot of TAs working online with students to help them get the work done. CS50 does that in the edX model. And so, those are MOOCs that the massiveness is mitigated by contact with some instructor or TA. And I'm sure that will evolve over time. I do think it's very important for universities to change the cost curve of higher education. And, I can see schools in the next several years having to decide whether someone arrives having done a lot of work online, whether through MOOCs or other online classes, and so they spend less time in college, or the time they spend in college can be used to go more deeply into whatever material they're studying. And that'll be a choice that both consumers/students and providers/universities make. Some students will want to get out more quickly. Others will want to do the equivalent of a master's in 4 years because they've already done a lot of the introductory courses before they get to campus. And colleges and universities will have to decide. I do think, and I've written about this, as you say, I do think that it's a really good thing that the conventional calendar of learning is being disrupted. That is, there's no pedagogical reason why 4 years is the magic number for a BA. There's no curricular necessity for that. And figuring out how students can customize an education with advice from thoughtful faculty members, customize it in such a way as that it remains broad and contextual while giving them expertise in specific fields, that would be the sweet spot, really, going forward, rather than dumbing down American education or making it overly vocational, to make it deeper and more intentional by being more open to customization. I think that would be a great outcome of the kind of choices that Coursera and Udacity and edX are offering students today.
There's also some sense that these online courses will, if not lead to a new flowering, new openings for learning liberal arts, which, as you say, in an era when higher ed is getting very vocational.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's possible. I mean, it could go the other way, too. The analogy with the music industry may not be so bad. There are a lot of people who bemoan the fact that now you don't have to buy a whole CD to get the songs you want. And that's just the way it is now. People can still get the whole CD, but they can also take what they want from the music put out there by artists. Now, of course, artists have suffered in this transition, but the other thing that's happened is you can find music that before you would have had to search forever in record stores. You can find now music from the most obscure bands, the most esoteric genres of music. You can find it and have access to it and appreciate it and love it. And that the kind of long tail of music is much more accessible than it ever was. And I think the long tail of education will also be more accessible than it ever was. And I'm really impressed that a course in Greek history or the modern and the postmodern attract these numbers of students. And I do believe that we can resist narrow vocationalism by offering really high quality educational opportunities to students who want to broaden their thinking. That tension between vocational and liberal learning goes back well before the founding of the United States. It comes up again in acute ways in different periods. I'm just finishing a book called Why Liberal Education Matters. You know, and throughout American history, there's been this tension between the vocational and the liberal, let's call it. And that's going to continue. But I do think that technology will offer us more access to a wider variety of subjects and forms of learning.
It'll be interesting to see the kind of numbers that sign up the second time the same course is taken. Speaking of that, when modernism, postmodernism is taught again in July, is it going to be the exact same material from when the class was first taught, or if you recorded new lectures or have new assignments, for example?
No, I tweak the assignments, and I have a list of things to fix from one of my TAs. Now she's going to be a junior, so she's really bold now. She's telling me all the things I have to improve. But I'm going to resist the urge to record new lectures this time, and part of this is to do it at a reasonable investment for Wesleyan. You know, we're giving these classes away, and that in some ways means tuition is how we operate mostly. You know, 70% of our budget is from tuition, so I don't want to spend more resources on these classes because they're resources that come from our on-campus students. So the short answer is no, I'm not changing the lectures. I'm not adding new material. I'm going to run it again, and maybe there won't be as many students this time. Maybe there'll be more. I have no idea. But that is the model. It really works best if you can repeat classes and then improve them after you've run them a few times rather than try to redo them each time. Because that will then lead to higher costs and not necessarily better classes.
And last question, you're one of, I think, six or seven professors who have given courses through Wesleyan and Coursera. What's been the experience of your colleagues?
They are very, very excited by it. I think that there are two younger professors. They're tenured, but on the younger side, and they just really, really excited by their experience. And Lisa Dierker's statistics class is just the subject of some blogs in the technology sphere. And some universities, I'm told, are adopting her class as a statistics primer for graduate students. I know Scott Higgins was really excited about his film studies class and how enthusiastic the students were. But also, my colleagues who've been teaching here for 35, 40 years in economics and classics, they're highly decorated teachers on campus. You know, they've won all these awards. It was kind of risky for them to jump into the deep end of the pool in a whole different way of teaching. But both of them did so with gusto, and the classics professor, Andy Segedy-Mazak, is very enthusiastic about the response of his students, and he is actually recording some new lectures, and he wants to add some material in one or two areas where students were especially curious. And then Richie Adelstein in economics, he felt that he learned a lot about what he does on campus that he really can't do online. There's a kind of Socratic dimension to his on-campus teaching. I guess it's similar to my own teaching. That is, he needs the feedback immediately in order to keep the lecture going. And you can't do that online because you have to record the whole lecture. And so that's given him some reflection on what doesn't translate between the campus and the online community. But he, too, was very pleased at having done this. And I think it has also helped him finish a writing project, made more progress on it because he actually had to give his own answers to his own questions. I could put it that way in the online version. Whereas on campus, he leaves the questions out there for his students to wrestle with. That for him was really an instructive difference. Although I think he can't ask those same questions on campus because now students can go listen to his videos and hear his answers. So he's going to have to rejigger his class here at Wesleyan.
Well, I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts with listeners at Degree of Freedom.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Nice to talk with you, and good luck with your project.
That was Michael Roth, president of Wesleyan University and the professor behind The Modern and the Postmodern. And as you heard, this course is on the verge of being offered again by Coursera, which means a new cadre can enjoy what I and tens of thousands of other students participated in when the course was first taught earlier this year. Given how much the nature of humanities courses can be impacted by what type of students enroll and participate in online discussions and peer grading, I suspect that the course will have a different flavor every time it's taken. While a flavor is a challenging concept to quantify, other data, such as the number of enrollees, is an easy statistic to determine. And I think the number of students who participate the second time around will be an important indicator of what we can expect more broadly as MOOCs are given for a second, third, or fourth time. For instance, it may be that those of us who took the course the first time around are early adopters of new learning technologies and new courses. And as information about courses like Roth's Modernism class becomes more widespread, it may turn out that there are tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of new students ready to walk the path blazed by those of us who took the course the first time. At the same time, it may turn out that folks like me represent a pent-up demand for high-quality humanities MOOCs on subjects like philosophy and literature. And if that demand has been largely sated, that would likely result in enrollment in this summer's release of the course going down. Repeating a class also brings up other issues we should be thinking about as more and more MOOC classes are completed, making it possible to release and re-release courses already in the can. President Roth already pointed out his feelings that it's best to let a course percolate a few times before making major changes. But given that his classroom version of the course has evolved over time, it's more than likely the online version will also be subject to change if it becomes a Coursera staple in the years to come. And once a course is in the can, there may come a time that course developers and providers are faced with an issue of whether to continue giving those courses based on a fixed calendar, an option I call synchronous learning, versus letting students enroll, begin and end the class anytime they like, what I call asynchronous learning. We've already seen synchronous versus asynchronous learning in the MOOC world. For example, the courses I've taken from Udacity have all been asynchronous, allowing me to fit classes into my schedule versus working to keep up with weekly releases of lectures, readings, homework assignments, and assessments. And some of the alternative free learning resources I've been exploring, such as the curated courses offered by Sailor.org, are all based on self-paced learning with no start or end date. While my personal preference is for synchronous courses that force me to keep up with a subject from week to week, I can also appreciate the flexibility provided by asynchronous learning solutions that let me fit a course in where and when I can and allow me to move at my own pace. So I'm bringing this distinction up not to praise one course format and condemn the other, but to highlight how the MOOC experiment is indeed an experiment. One which not just allows, but cries out for educators to try different things at different times and build what they've learned from teaching the course one time into the next instantiation of the same course. So it remains to be seen if the 30,000 of us who took Professor Roth's Modern and the Postmodern are the bulk of the existing audience, the start of a growing trend, or simply a control group that can be used to measure against when decisions regarding a successful course center around where to go next with it. Just one more thing to think about as we find out how these trends play out at, among other places, the next Degree of Freedom podcast.